I next met with Dr. Lindsay Wilmot, a gynecologic oncologist from Phoenix, Arizona, and to begin, we talked about a 52-year-old woman with stage 3 ovarian cancer from her practice.
So this patient initially underwent a debulking surgery. She had debulking to no gross residual. And then following her surgery, she underwent standard of care chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. She actually had a pretty decent interval in between her treatments before she had her first recurrence. And she went on to maintenance bevacizumab following her initial chemotherapy. So she received carboplatin, paclitaxel, then maintenance bevacizumab because of her high risk factors at the time of surgery. That's not standard of care in the United States, as you know. In Europe, ICON 7 most recently demonstrated that for patients who have high risk disease, they may benefit. In fact, they do benefit from bevacizumab maintenance. Those patients on ICON 7 were also treated with triplet therapy in the upfront setting. So carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab followed by bevacizumab maintenance. This was a bit of an extrapolation from that by adding in the bevacizumab maintenance following the upfront carboplatin paclitaxel. But the patient did do very well, and she had really no toxicity related to her maintenance therapy. And I find that when patients are treated with bevacizumab as a maintenance, they actually have good quality of life. They come in every 3 weeks for their infusion. They're only in the office for about an hour for their infusion, and then they go about their lives. They can go right back to work. So as far as a maintenance therapy, I think bevacizumab, from a quality of life standpoint, is very good.
You know, it's interesting that you said that, because for this survey, we asked the physician for each type of therapy the patient got to say, were they able to sort of cruise through it without any dose modification? Did they have to have some kind of modification because of toxicity, but they were able to continue? Or did they have it stop? It was interesting because all the chemo regimens, whether or not there was a biologic with it, most of the patients had dose adjustment. But for example, bevacizumab alone, either as maintenance or as therapy for recurrent disease, very few patients had any dose. So kind of we had sort of objective support from what you're saying. Getting back to this issue, though, of chemotherapy and ovarian cancer and toxicities, what are the kinds of toxicities that you see, particularly in the earlier lines of therapy when platinum's being used, that will cause you to have to adjust the dose or the schedule?
Well, in early lines of therapy with platinum, probably the most commonly encountered toxicity would be fatigue. And then, of course, bone marrow toxicity, which is, for carboplatin in particular, neutropenia is its dose-limiting toxicity. So in general, that toxicity is not often very significant, especially in first-line therapy. In general, that can be modified with the addition of bone marrow supportive agents, especially in elderly populations who may be more prone to neutropenia and then subsequent infections and infectious morbidity. But in general, I feel like carboplatin as a first-line agent is relatively tolerable. However, its classic doublet, paclitaxel, an excellent drug, the neuropathy I have found actually can be a rather challenging side effect for patients. This I often will mitigate with medications to assist with the peripheral toxicity, so using vitamin B6, using gabapentin, and then some stimulatory exercises for peripheral neuropathy, like using rice or sand or other things to trigger the hands and feet that can have some benefit potentially. But obviously, if the patients are having persistent neuropathy or neuropathy that's interfering with their ability to perform daily functions, then they require either dose reductions or changing the second agent.
I hadn't heard that thing about the rice and sand. That's interesting. Did you make that? Where did that come from?
This is something I recently learned from a physical therapist.
Wow.
That was one of their techniques. To be honest, I don't know that there is good data showing that it helps, but this is something that that particular practitioner employs as part of their physical therapy for neuropathy, and they found benefit from it. So I have started to have some of my patients use it. They do a couple of different things. You can use like a little bean bag filled with rice, or, you know, the stress ball type things, or putting rice into a shoebox and then having the patient kind of just step in there and place a little pressure.
Huh.
I don't know how much it helps, but I think it gives the patient something to do. And a lot of my patients do state that they feel like when they're using their hands that they feel better. And then when they try to go to sleep at night, they're really noticing that discomfort from the neuropathy. But obviously, once you're starting to deal with functional limitations secondary to neuropathy, you've gotten to a higher level of toxicity and you have to really intervene to prevent permanent damage.
What about the issue of bevacizumab? In a way, I was surprised, and I wasn't surprised that we didn't see much toxicity, but specifically in ovarian cancer, as opposed to some of the other solid tumors, for example, we've heard issues about bowel perforation and bowel problems, but I don't know whether it's because now we know how to select the patients that we didn't really see that in the survey. Do you still see that, and what kinds of situations?
I luckily have never seen a bowel perforation in one of my patients. However, I have helped care for one of my partner's patients who experienced a perforation on bevacizumab. This patient had had multiple prior lines of therapy. I believe that she was on her third or fourth line of therapy, and we know that that is a risk that increases that toxicity. So more lines of therapy equates to an increased risk of bowel perforation with bevacizumab. So that being said, I think it is important to some patients and practitioners choose to hold bevacizumab until later lines of therapy, but you may be at the same time potentially increasing your risk of an associated bowel perforation. Obviously, we suspect that distribution of disease also may contribute to the patients who experience a bowel perforation. The problem is, obviously, that's a very significant toxicity. Even if it only occurs in very few patients, that toxicity can be life-threatening and challenging to manage. So it's important, I think, to counsel patients regarding that potential risk. But luckily, it seems that when used correctly and in the right setting, the risk is rather low.
So you mentioned neuropathy, and I see that later on, we'll talk about this, this patient ended up getting nab-paclitaxel, which I was going to ask you about. Any clinical impressions or from clinical research in terms of neuropathy with nab as opposed to paclitaxel?
Neuropathy can still obviously occur with nab-paclitaxel. However, it does appear to be less. So that toxicity is mitigated by the delivery system, and the nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel appears to have less neuropathy than those who are receiving traditional paclitaxel. But it is still something that you have to watch for. I have actually used nab-paclitaxel in my patients who have had neuropathy related to paclitaxel, as long as their neuropathy is acceptable, and then I carefully monitor them for that toxicity. And I've had good success, actually, in that patient population with acceptable levels of toxicity and no increase in toxicity with nab-paclitaxel.
Going back to the initial treatment for this patient and really kind of looking in general at the sequence that she received, first of all, you mentioned the fact that this patient actually was given bevacizumab as maintenance up front. How do you approach that decision? And when you do it, do you generally do it with the chemo and then maintenance? And is the maintenance for a defined period of time?
So I do utilize that strategy. In general, I actually prefer to use dose-dense weekly paclitaxel in my metastatic ovarian cancer patients. That obviously was demonstrated to have equivalent efficacy in a more recent GOG trial to Q3-week carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab. So using carboplatin plus dose-dense weekly paclitaxel without bevacizumab in the upfront setting. So that's my personal preference. And then it's an interesting extrapolation, but I am, in fact, extrapolating from the ICON 7 data. And also, even if you look back at the GOG 218 data, the use of bevacizumab in maintenance did have an improvement in progression-free survival. The ICON 7 data is even more convincing, and that's why they got the European label. But I think that for patients who have high-risk disease, so those who had neoadjuvant chemotherapy and high burden of disease, patients who had a debulking that was not optimal, patients who had high volume ascites or some sort of disease within their chest, I think these patients are at higher risk to have a recurrence, and they are the patients who benefited with bevacizumab maintenance. So those are the patients that I consider for bevacizumab maintenance. In general, the big thing that we have to watch for bevacizumab toxicity is high blood pressure. So that's an important thing that I counsel my patients about, especially those who have pre-existing hypertension. And then the risk that is not actually zero, it actually does happen with proteinuria. And so I think especially with prolonged use of bevacizumab, that is a toxicity that you may be a little bit more apt to see. So those are the things I especially counsel my patients on. Obviously, there are other less common toxicities associated with bevacizumab. But in general, these patients seem to tolerate it rather well. And I think that there, in the carefully selected patient, could be some benefit for treatment-free intervals.
Have you had to stop treatment because of proteinuria? Have you seen nephrotic syndrome?
I have. yes to both answers.
Wow.
The label states that if you're having greater than 2 grams of protein per day on a 24-hour urine, then you need to stop the medication. And I have had actually a couple of patients experience that. Some of whom have actually never went back on the drug because their proteinuria persisted, not to nephrotic range, but to a range where I felt that it wasn't acceptable to resume them on a medication that would likely worsen their renal function. So yes, it can happen, and I have seen it. There is a question, of course, if this is a dose-dependent phenomenon. So in the United States, we usually use 15 milligrams per kilogram dosing, whereas in Europe, they will use 10 or 7.5 milligrams per kilogram. And so there could be a difference based on the higher dose that we use in the United States. That is challenging to know because that would be a single person, me, trying to decide if that affects my patients. But I think that that is definitely a toxicity I've seen and something that I do watch for. We do a urine protein analysis before each infusion.
So this patient got 21 months of Bev maintenance and then had disease progression. I found it interesting that she got CarboGem, but she also continued the Bev. What was the thinking there?
Yes, so this is that bevacizumab after bevacizumab question. And so obviously it's not really ever been answered in a formal clinical trial as of yet. But the thinking and logic is that when you extract bevacizumab from patients' therapy, that you may change their tumor phenotype and you actually may expand tumor growth. And if the toxicity is acceptable, it doesn't appear to increase the risks of treatment. So there, hopefully you can maintain the benefit of the bevacizumab while adding in a cytotoxic therapy.
And actually, it's interesting because this woman then went on to receive 12 months of maintenance bevacizumab. Now, after the CarboGem bevacizumab, when she had disease progression, I guess actually it's at that point when she got her CarboGem Bev for recurrent disease and then went on to Bev maintenance, it would be at that point, I guess, where this new PARP data on niraparib would kick in. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, that, well, interestingly, it's the patient would have been more of a candidate for it right after her CarboGem as opposed to after her maintenance Bev. You know, right after her cytotoxic therapy.
Exactly. That's sort of what, in other words, instead of getting Bev.
Yes.
I don't know whether 6 months from now, if niraparib gets approved, if she's going to be getting niraparib.
Right. Exactly. That is the question is, will the substitution now be for a PARP inhibitor for maintenance therapy? And it's absolutely going to depend on what approvals they go for, obviously, with the FDA approval committees and then what they have accepted. If it's going to end up being accepted, which my suspicion is that it'll be accepted for patients with a germline BRCA mutation or those with somatic HRD, as opposed to everybody, I think that that will be a very interesting thing to see if people start adopting PARP maintenance instead of classic bevacizumab maintenance. You know, I actually have spoken with a lot of members of the community around the country, and there are not a lot of practitioners who are utilizing bevacizumab maintenance. A lot of that is because they can't get it approved by insurance. And so because the medication is very expensive, without insurance approval or authorization, it wouldn't be utilized. So I think that PARP maintenance actually will have good uptake and utilization. I'm just curious to see once we start seeing it practiced in the communities, our providers and practitioners are dealing with toxicity and their methods and mechanisms for kind of managing the doses and toxicities associated with the PARP, because the data does suggest that there is an important dose-dependent relationship to the PARP dose and the outcome. And so I am curious to see what kind of real-world data will show.
Well, first of all, I don't know if you're a betting person, but I'm putting my money on FDA approves it as maintenance, regardless of HRD or not, but we'll see. But also, the point about toxicity is interesting, particularly if you're going to use it for a long period of time. They used it until disease progression. So, you know, GI problems, I don't know if you're going to see that with this particular drug as opposed to olaparib. But they have reported, I think, myelosuppression has definitely been seen, but it looks like they see more thrombocytopenia with this.
Yes. The big question is myelodysplastic syndrome, thrombocytopenia, anemia, which absolutely does occur with olaparib and likely is a PARP phenomenon, and then the GI toxicities. I think the GI toxicities are something that can be addressed prophylactically, and that's how we do it in my practice. So we have the patients fill their prescription and have a prescription for an antiemetic at home, as well as fill a prescription for an antidiarrheal medication, so that if they even start to have baseline experience of those symptoms, they can start taking the medications and stay on top of the symptoms instead of letting the symptoms overtake them. I think that that works very well and helps to prevent the need for any dose adjustments or dose delays. And then as far as for anemia, really the recommendation is to transfuse. So to transfuse through the drug as opposed to reducing the dose or holding the dose. Thrombocytopenia, on the other hand, as you know, is a much more challenging phenomenon and can be rather problematic. Again, I had a partner who had a patient who experienced very severe thrombocytopenia, requiring multiple transfusions of platelets, and her platelet count never really rebounded, so she couldn't get any additional therapy, PARP or otherwise. So it is definitely something to watch out for, be cognizant of.
So I see that this woman, as is recommended, was tested for BRCA germline mutation, was negative. What type of test do you use? And do you automatically send patients for genetic counseling, or do you try to do it yourself?
So I generally use the testing and the companion diagnostic, what was initially approved for olaparib. So that companion diagnostic testing was the FDA-approved test for olaparib, though, as we have all experienced, you don't have to have used the companion diagnostic to get the olaparib approved. However, that test, you can either use just the companion diagnostic, which is BRCA1 and 2 testing, and then it can reflex if negative to a panel test or perform a panel test. I think that's a big source of interest right now, is what is the better thing to do? Should you test first for BRCA1 and 2 and then kind of reflex if they are negative, or should you just go right to the panel test? Because there are some other interesting mutations that are not included in the BRCA1 and 2 testing that can have implications for other malignancies and treatments. So I think that I have been kind of looking at patients' family histories to help to decide if I want to do a companion diagnostic and then reflex versus just moving right to the panel.
So this lady received, amazingly, 8 lines of therapy, then went to hospice and died. First of all, about how many patients a year die in your practice?
Well, I feel like because I am somewhat new out of fellowship still, and because ovarian cancer has become such a long-term illness to treat, I luckily have not had that many patients pass away from their disease. Patients that I've helped my partners treat, I've seen that more because they've been more established in their care. However, in general, I see probably at least a couple of new ovarian cancer patients a month. And over the course of a year, I probably have a couple of those patients pass away. I think that it's fair to say that the general life expectancy for an ovarian cancer patient is several years, multiple years now, hopefully even longer than that. So I think that's probably a fair estimate for what other practitioners are seeing as well.
Now, how long was it that you were actually yourself taking care of her, roughly?
About 2 years.
2 years. So first of all, I'm kind of curious if you can talk a little bit about her as a person. Did she have a spouse? And what was her circle of loved ones?
She did have a spouse and she did have family. So I feel like she was supported. You know, I think that a lot of our patients are very educated and, you know, involved in their care. She was very excited about enrollment into clinical trials. And she absolutely wanted to try and push forward with whatever treatment modalities were available. I also think that she had appropriate expectations for her care. She did not want to just stop treatment without considering what options were available, but she had appropriate expectations for what those treatments may allow. So in other words, I don't think she expected that on fourth or fifth line of therapy, she was going to have disease resolution and have, you know, many years off of treatment. I think she appropriately understood goals of treatment change as you get further down the line. And she had good family support to help her with these decisions.
She had children?
She did, yes. She had 2 children.
How old were they?
2 children who were in their 20s.
And we had asked the question in the survey, did the patient have any short-term goals that they were trying to get to, understanding the limitations of what they're dealing with? And you wrote down here, child graduation. What happened there?
For every patient, there is often a short-term goal. So watching their child graduate from college or from a professional school, I think that these are the things that patients really hold on to, you know, seeing their child get married, have their own children or a grandchild. These are the things that patients really kind of hold on to help, I think, get them or propel them perhaps like the last 8 months down the line, as was the case for this patient. She wanted to see her child graduate from college.
Anything else you want to share about her as a person and what it was like to take care of her?
You know, I think she was a very motivated patient. She was a young woman who was diagnosed with a challenging condition, and she was very involved with her care in that she really wanted to read up on the things that we were recommending for her. She wanted to understand the clinical trials that we were enrolling her in or talking to her about enrollment. I think she really, truly wanted to make the most out of her time. And, you know, she absolutely wanted to involve her family in decisions. So I think that she was, although unfortunately very young, I feel like she felt fulfilled in her treatment and supported. And I don't think she felt disappointed and what the outcome was. I think she felt like she had done everything that she could and she felt fulfilled.
And like the vast majority of patients, at least in this project, this woman entered hospice and she was in there, was in the hospice program for 6 weeks before she died. What were the major palliative issues at the end of life for her?
Unfortunately, for most of my ovarian cancer patients, the most significant palliative outcomes or issues are usually related to bowel, small bowel, and nausea, vomiting, obstruction, and then, of course, fatigue. And so if I recall correctly for this patient, that she was similar. The bowel obstruction issues can be pretty overwhelming for a lot of these patients, and not being able to eat, the fatigue that's associated with that, the fatigue associated with being nauseated all the time. And so I think that that is the hardest one to tackle because palliating nausea can be challenging. I use a lot of venting gastrostomy tubes in patients at the end of life because I think that that will still give them the ability to be able to at least swallow some water or maybe some, you know, yogurt, and then they can vent it out through their gastrostomy tube and still have some quality of life, you know, still be able to try to participate in that action of swallowing or drinking without hopefully having untoward nausea. So that's one of my mechanisms for dealing with nausea as a side effect.
Now, there were a couple things in her course that we often see in patients who get beyond all approved or acceptable types of therapy. One is that she actually got treated with nivolumab, the checkpoint inhibitor, anti-PD-1 agent. What happened there? How did you actually get into that discussion and access? This is outside of a trial or in a trial?
This is outside of a trial. This is actually via my partner. And yes, she did try the nivolumab. She did have some toxicity associated that she had a lot of GI-related toxicity associated with her nivolumab. So she had to come off of that drug. But the goal, of course, of checkpoint inhibitors, and it has had pretty dramatic effects in other tumor types, and the theory is that ovarian cancer is similar in some of its immunomodulation, and so nivolumab may be effective. So based on her prior lines of therapy, off clinical trial, she was able to get it approved from her insurance company and receive the drug, but unfortunately did not receive a very full course of the drug related to her toxicities.
What, did she have diarrhea or what happened?
Yes, severe diarrhea.
Wow. That seems unusual. Maybe related to the prior surgery. I found it interesting. You know, we just thought it would be interesting to ask people for these cases, first of all, to what extent they felt attached to the patient. And you wrote very attached. And also to what extent the doctor in that specific case felt a sense of satisfaction in taking care of this patient. And you checked off very satisfied. Can you kind of comment on those two answers you gave?
Well, I think with any patient, when you have regular interaction with patients for their treatment and you get to know them and their family, you develop a degree of attachment to them as a physician. So mostly for me, that means or translates to me wanting to help them to get to their goals, obviously. So for example, graduation, but also maximizing their quality of life and trying to give them appropriate expectations. So I think when we're dealing with end-of-life therapies or therapies that are many modalities down the line, expectations obviously change. And for some patients, that can be very challenging to accept that they're no longer headed toward a cure or even toward no evidence of disease, but instead perhaps stable disease. And so that's obviously a grossly different concept for patients and their families. And so I think talking them through that, making them understand, trying to help them kind of phase into the idea of palliative medicine. I like to introduce palliative care relatively early toward the end of life, so that at least they can become accustomed to that idea and understand the physicians involved with palliative care. They're helpful for a lot of palliative related symptoms, including pain and shortness of breath, nausea. And then I think it helps a transition to the idea of hospice when appropriate. So for me, it's a lot of talking. I definitely am a physician that takes a lot of time with my patients, which of course leads to, unfortunately, some later visits with the later patients in the day. But I think all my patients appreciate that. They know that I'm taking time with each and every patient. And so that can mean long conversations about where are we going to go, what are we going to do. And I think that naturally just lends itself to some degree of attachment to a patient and their family and to their outcome and to their quality of life.
You said that you found it satisfying to take care of the patient. What were some of the things that gave you that sense of satisfaction?
Well, I think it's always a good feeling to be able to help somebody to feel better. And I think that it was very interesting, the various lines of therapy she received, clinical trial enrollment. I always am enthusiastic about clinical trial enrollment. And so I think that it's a great opportunity for our patients to get on some of these trials. So I do have some extra enthusiasm when I can enroll patients in clinical trials. But for me, you know, especially at the end of life, it's really all about trying to help their family and themselves to have maximum quality of life. And so that means when rounding on them in the hospital, pulling up a chair and sitting and talking with them for a while, seeing what it is that I can do to help them out. And I feel like if I can help someone to successfully transition from the idea of treatment to palliation to end-of-life care, that gives me a great deal of satisfaction. If I can help the family to feel supported, that really gives me a great deal of satisfaction. I think that, unfortunately, there are a number of patients that we won't be able to cure, and so we have to focus on their other needs. And while that may mean a very exciting new clinical trial or some new modality, it also means helping them to understand what their death will be like and how I can help them to feel as comfortable as possible through that process.
I noticed also that this woman had next generation sequencing done on her tumor. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like there was anything that they saw there. But is that something that you generally offer to patients to sort of get out beyond the usual therapies?
It's something I consider. There are a number of places that do this. And I think that it is definitely going to be the next wave of the future in more personalized cancer care, especially as we have more actionable targets. I think currently I don't use it for all of my patients by any means, perhaps a very select patient population who has odd tumor behavior or biology, or for whom I feel like options for therapy are limited but have a good performance status and so perhaps could be candidates for alternative agents. So those are the patients I usually select for tumor sequencing.
So I want to try to pick one of the other cases. I actually had three or four other ones that we were going to talk about, but I kind of like you to just look through the other cases. And if there's any case that you think would be interesting or any patient you thought was different as a person or you were close with, or maybe you can talk about this 59-year-old lady and begin with how she presented.
Sure. This patient actually presented, unfortunately, her mother had recently become very ill, and so she had been helping take care of her mother. And so she had ignored some symptoms of her own while caring for her mother, who subsequently passed away, namely some abdominal distension and pain. After her mother passed away, she finally came in for an evaluation and she was found to have a pelvic mass. So she was then referred to me. She, at the time of her initial referral, had a CT scan, which was suggestive of some peritoneal implants, and had an elevated CA-125. So she's young and had an excellent performance status. So I actually brought her back for a exploratory surgery just to evaluate her disease status and hoped for a debulking. But unfortunately, at the time of that surgery, she had significant disease involving plaques of the diaphragm, unresectable disease in the bowel, and bowel mesentery. And I felt that she was not going to be a candidate for a debulking to no gross residuals. So I simply took some biopsies and then proceeded with neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
Let me ask you, in what situations do you do neoadjuvant therapy?
So I prefer to do neoadjuvant therapy off the bat, and any patient who has severe ascites and likely has significant carcinomatosis that won't be amenable to debulking. Anyone with, you know, a high volume pleural effusion and other evidence of significant disease within the abdomen. Any patient who has what appears to be significant disease within the small bowel mesentery and that won't be debulkable. Those patients, I will usually obtain an IR-guided biopsy, a core biopsy, and then proceed with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. I don't usually bring my patients back for evaluations for debulking capability unless I feel they're likely to be someone who can be debulked. So in other words, if someone has those other characteristics based on imaging or physical exam, I proceed right to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But if I feel that they possibly could be a debulking candidate, then I will bring them back for either a laparoscopy to evaluate disease burden or proceed with a laparotomy.
So what were you thinking about at that point?
At the time of her surgery. So she had very significant disease, which was not resectable. So I felt that I did not think that putting her through a suboptimal debulking, she would have been left with quite a bit of residual disease, would be beneficial to her. So instead, I just wanted to obtain some tissue for diagnosis and close. When I do these via laparotomy, I do a very small mini laparotomy. So in general, it is something that they can heal quickly from, and it doesn't delay their onset of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So that's what I performed in her circumstance. This particular patient did not enroll in a clinical trial. She received neoadjuvant chemotherapy and had partial disease response based on her imaging and CA-125, but I did bring her back for an interval debulking. And at the time of her interval debulking, unfortunately, she still had a rather significant amount of residual disease, but I was able to debulk her to no gross residual. However, there are more recent publications that suggest that tumor response based on pathologic assays are likely to detect patient outcome in the long run, and I think this patient falls into that group. She had very minimal tumor response. They didn't use that assay that was discussed in the article, but just based on her clinical appearance, her response to platinum was poor. And that's really what happened in her clinical course as well. She completed her adjuvant therapy and was without evidence of disease, but then very rapidly had disease recurrence.
And maybe you can just carry on in terms of what happened to her.
Sure. So she had platinum-resistant disease recurrence. And so based on Aurelia, she was placed onto PLD bevacizumab. And she had disease progression on that regimen. Her presentation with her disease progression was severe nausea and vomiting and a bowel obstruction. And so she was admitted for that, initially treated medically with decompression, but she did undergo a diversion procedure to try and help her symptomatically. But she really unfortunately progressed very rapidly at this point as far as her disease burden and her performance status dropped off rapidly despite her young age. And so she wasn't felt to be a candidate for any further therapy and then was placed onto hospice. However, she was able to get married after her diagnosis. She had a long-term boyfriend and he proposed to her and they were able to get married. She, I think, was able to enjoy some time with him and he was very supportive of her during her treatment. So this case sticks out in my mind because it's very different than the typical ovarian cancer patient with her disease, rapid progression and really poor response of her disease to multiple different agents. But I think that she, you know, having just seen her mom pass away, I feel like she had some degree of understanding of death that perhaps other younger patients don't. And she really wanted to focus on time with her husband and trying to really be as symptom-free as possible. And I think that following her diversion procedure, her nausea did improve and she was able to be comfortable and pass away comfortably.
What was it like for you to take care of her?
It was very emotional, to be honest. I actually felt frustrated with her disease. It definitely defied the expectations. Usually when I'm talking to patients about neoadjuvant chemotherapy, one of the things I think we can emphasize that in general, high-grade serous ovarian cancers are very platinum sensitive. And so neoadjuvant chemotherapy is typically very effective. And oftentimes, though they have higher risk disease than other patients, we can have certain expectations about what their disease process may look like. And for her, you know, it was frustrating because none of those expectations really panned out. She didn't have really any significant time from the time I met her where she wasn't under treatment, active treatment with cytotoxic chemotherapy. I think that that is an unfortunate thing because obviously our goal is to get patients treated and then hopefully have them without evidence of disease on either some maintenance, which hopefully has acceptable toxicity, or no treatment at all so that they can enjoy their lives. And for this patient, that wasn't the case.
So, you know, we kind of look at this as sort of the oncology version of the M&M, the mortality and morbidity conference, you know, that the surgeons usually do where, you know, somebody came to the ER and got shot, whatever. Would you have done anything differently? But more at an oncologic level. So, again, one of the things we asked in the survey, and I'm going to ask you about this patient, actually about your other patient, too, is, you know, is there anything you would have done differently, either in the oncologic management or in your support of her, looking back on that?
I would have to say for this patient, no, there isn't anything I would have done differently. I think that I had a lot of open and honest conversations with her once we saw how her disease was responding. I sat down with her after her debulking and I explained that she still had a lot of disease. And though it was all resected, that did not have necessarily the best prognostic factor, that her disease had persisted despite her platinum therapy. So I feel like she was at least prepared for what was to come. I can't imagine that there were many other options or treatments available that would have been successful for her. And so I think that when you're dealing with a platinum-resistant phenotype, options are very limited. And even when you look at the Aurelia data, though there was advantage for the addition of bevacizumab, we're only talking about a few months. So these patients overall are obviously ill and likely not to do very well. So I think that she received appropriately aggressive management and had a good fair share at treating her disease, and I can't think that I would do much different. I think that the biggest thing for patients like this is in the counseling and expectations, as we talked about before. The conversation is advanced much earlier in the treatment course when you're dealing with patients with this kind of phenotype. And so for them, it can be much harder to grasp. You know, it can take a lot longer to come around to the idea that their disease is not responding as we hoped, as opposed to a patient who has been under treatment for 5 or 6 years. And then they may be a little bit more likely to understand what's happening. If you just met someone and you've treated them and they're only 8 months down the line in their treatment course and you're telling them that their disease has a resistant phenotype and unlike, you know, we're going to have to try a different regimen and, you know, we'll have to see how they respond, but cure is not going to be a possibility. That's a lot to deal with in such a short amount of time. So I think helping expectations is a big part of that management and that clinical management, even more than maybe necessarily giving the medications. It's really about being a human being and helping them to understand what's going on.
So I'm imagining a resident or a fellow making rounds with you and hearing about this patient and saying to you, isn't it depressing to be in this field? How do you deal with it?
Yes, that's a very funny thing that you asked me that, because that's the question people ask, you know, residents, medical students, or just when you're at a dinner party or sitting on a plane, you know, people want to know what it is that you do. And when I respond that I'm a female cancer doctor, the kind of tone always drops a little bit. But I think the thing that I want to emphasize to the residents who are considering it as their future or to people who I'm just meeting on the street is that cancer care is a lot more than just treating a cancer. I wanted to go into this field because, you know, I love surgery, obviously, and I love medicine and I love these drugs and these novel combinations. But the thing that I really love are my patients. And so if you can have the personality where you enjoy sitting down and talking to someone and getting to know them and their family, what makes them tick, what are their goals and desires, how do they feel about end of life, you know, are they religious, what is it that they need to feel comfortable? These are the things that make people tick and that make people run. And that's really, as an oncologist, that's what you're caring for. That's the person that you're caring for. And so, you know, I tell the people that unfortunately there are going to be a fair share of my patients who will pass away. And yes, that is sad. But if we can accomplish making them feel fulfilled, if we can help them to do the things that they wanted to do, like get married, see their grandchild born, if you can make their family feel supported and understand that there are services available, and you can prepare people for what it will be like when they die, then to me, that is fulfilling. And that gives me a good sense of purpose. And it's a huge part of what I do as an oncologist. So I feel like, although it's sad, it's also extremely rewarding. And so although it's a little bit of a Debbie Downer at the dinner conversation, I think people, they get it once you explain it that way.
What was it like for you when you found out she was going to be married and that whole process?
I was happy for her. You know, I really was. She's my, I think, one of my first patients, older patients, who has gotten married during her treatment. But I've had so many patients who have had daughters or sons get married or who wanted to go on a vacation, some vacation to a place that, for example, one of my patients is from New Zealand and she wanted to go home for a family reunion or, you know, to see just the premiere of their favorite show. I mean, people have the funny things that they really want to do with their lives, but that's what makes them feel excited. And so for this patient, I just felt happy. You know, I think it's important that even though you're undergoing something like cancer treatment, you're still alive for that moment. So you should try to, you know, live for every moment that you have. And that's what she was doing. And I think we all get caught up and we forget that silly concept that, you know, every day is a day that you should embrace. And she did that. I thought that was really pretty amazing. You know, she did it without any hair. She did it. She did it and she loved it and she was happy. And I think that's really awesome.